Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 378. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. So this is a bit of a bizarre episode for us, and we're going to do it a little bit out of order. And we have two amazing guests for you this week. I will actually tell you, our second guest is singer-songwriter Leslie Neuchow, and we had just a beautiful chat, which we recorded the day before the election. Today, this is the day after the election, and at 2:30 a.m., the race was called for Donald Trump. So one of the decisions that I made straight away as I looked on social media and saw what everyone around me was posting, I actually made the decision to not be on social media for 24 hours, just because I didn't think in my own self-care that would be in my best interest. So what I did was just posted something on there and said, hey, everybody, you know, take care of yourselves, take care of each other. And I posted a link because I wanted to put forth one resource. And the article that I posted was entitled, What Do We Tell the Children? And I'm honored beyond belief that at the very last minute, the author of that article is here with us. Dr. Ali Michael is the director of K-12 Consulting and Professional Development at the Center for the Study of Race and Equity in Education at the University of Pennsylvania. And she is the director of the Race Institute for K-12 Educators. She is the author of Raising Race Questions, Whiteness, Inquiry, and Education. She is also the co-editor of Everyday White People Confront Racial and Social Injustice. It's 15 different stories there. She penned this piece, What Do We Tell the Children? And we are welcoming her now. Ali, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. It is an honor to be here.
What do we make of all this? Let me actually ask the most important question. How are you doing?
You know, I watched the election returns last night, and I started out watching them with my daughter, who's six, and with my parents and my partner, and we were excited. We thought that we were going to have the first woman president, and we thought that this election had finally come to an end, and as soon as it started to become evident that Trump might win, my daughter went to bed. She was so upset. She went to bed immediately, and I couldn't do anything except begin to write, because I felt myself sinking into an abyss of despair and sadness and fear. And I think I've kind of been there since that moment. And you know, I got up today, and I had so many great messages from people who were excited to read the post and have something that helped orient them today. I spoke today by phone with multiple principals and teachers. I did a workshop for teachers that had been pre-planned. And it was really great to be out in the world taking action, because when I stop and I let it sink in, I feel really scared. And when I take action, when I start to write, when I'm in touch with people, when I'm supporting people or reaching out, then it mitigates some of the fear and despair that I feel.
Yeah, I feel like this perhaps affected the pre-planned workshop that you had to put forth to the world today.
Well, it was actually just what I needed. I was with a group of teachers and a superintendent who wanted to know, how do we talk to the children when they come back to school? And we did. We didn't do really anything that I planned, but I offered a series of exercises. I took them through a series of exercises that they could possibly use with their students to support their students to share their feelings and to process their feelings. And what was interesting in that exercise, a number of different feelings were shared. But one thing that I noted was that I heard people saying they were numb, they were sad, they were angry, they were in denial. And somebody even said that they were feeling acceptance. And I said to the group, do you realize that those are the stages of grief that we've right. just named, that we are actually going through stages of grief, and that that's exactly what will be happening for students who were not voting for Trump. I mean, obviously, we're going to have some students who were excited about Trump for lots of different reasons and who are going to be happy about it. But for students who felt threatened by Trump, who felt like their families were targeted by him or by his supporters, for students that did not want him to be elected, there is going to be grief, just like there was grief for a lot of the teachers in this group.
Yeah, I'm feeling reasonably confident, and this is not my area of expertise, that there's no way that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross envisioned her five stages of grief being applied to the American presidency.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct.
Not my area. Well, before we talk about what we say to the children, you know, I'm more on the higher ed side, but I certainly am working with other professors who are working with K-12 teachers. I would imagine that it's quite important that before we speak to the children, we first, in some ways, reconcile where it is that we're coming from. And I would also imagine this intersects quite a bit with the work that you do about race. But before we speak to the children, we should probably have a good sense of where it is we stand, right?
I think that that's true. I think that one of the reasons why this blog post resonated and spread so quickly today is that people didn't have that time. They were still figuring out how they felt when their kids woke up at 7 and then when they got to school at 8:30 and had to be present as adults. And so I agree that we need to find space for ourselves to process our own feelings, to see where we stand, and to find some clarity. But I think for a lot of people today, they didn't have that time. But I think you're right. Going forward, we need to create space to feel all the feels and to just let it sink in. And what I said with this group today is that no feelings are wrong. Feelings are right. And that's what we want to say to our kids, too. You know, you might be experiencing anger or sadness or fear today. You might be experiencing joy and pride today, that your feelings are not wrong. Whatever your feelings are, they're welcome. But we as a community need to be able to support one another in our feelings. And I think that that's really my message for schools and for classrooms, is that people have been traumatized by a national event. But we exist. We don't live on the national level. We exist and live in these smaller communities in which we really can know each other in three-dimensional ways beyond like single identities or party lines, where we can support each other's feelings. And one of the things I was asking the teachers to do today is to invite students to share their feelings anonymously so that they can understand the impact that this election is having on one another, and so that they can support one another. And not to make anybody feel badly, but just so that they can continue to build their community. And, you know, I sent out this article. My little sister is a professor of environmental science in Oregon, and she has 400 students who she speaks to. You know, her class has 400 students in it. And she said, you know, I just felt so disoriented. I felt so confused. And then I looked at a couple things on Facebook. I read your article, and I went into my class, and I told them that, you know, bigotry is not a democratic value, and that I honor each of you. And she went through and said, you know, I honor you if you're gay. I honor you if you're straight. I honor you if you're Black, and I honor you if you're Asian American, and I honor you if you're an immigrant, and I honor you if you're Latino, and I honor you if you're white. I honor you if your family's been here for three generations or two generations or one generation. I honor you if nobody from your family is from the United States. I honor you if you are disabled. I honor you if you're a man. I honor if you're a woman. Each, you know, she went on and on. She said, each one of you, I honor you because you are a unique individual and you belong in this classroom, and we are a community. And it is not, and bigotry does not belong in this classroom. And she said her students like gave her a standing ovation when Wow. she said that. It was like they had all this tension. And when she said bigotry does not belong in this classroom, they cheered. And then she went on to continue to talk. But her orientation was, it's okay to have the feelings that you're feeling. Who you are is welcome here, and every one of us is welcome here. And she said that she heard from a lot of her students that in other classes, the comments that professors were making were more divisive.
Yeah.
That they, and the student said, you know, even if you were a Hillary supporter, to have a professor talk in a way that really just kind of complains about Trump and supports Hillary makes you feel alienated from your classmates who supported Trump. But the way that she spoke about this apparently really helped them feel united as a community. And I think that's part of where we need to get. I mean, I'm not saying this is easy, but in schools and classrooms, we need to help people continue to be in relationship with one another and not be, you know, I mean, personally, I think that part of Trump's agenda is to divide Americans against each other. And so when we play into that, you know, we're letting him win a second time.
First of all, if you could relate to your sister, I will never complain, by the way, from here on out that my class of 21 students is too many. So I'm feeling a little bit bad about that right now, but I'll work through that. But I would also say that there are any number of environmental science professors and any number of K through 12 teachers who decided today, you know what, this is just not what I'm here to do, either on the college level, you know, and we hear this a lot, my area of scholarship and teaching is about race. So I know you hear this a lot as well, of people saying, well, it's just not what I'm there to do. It doesn't intersect with my course content, right? So make the case for why we should be having conversations with the children or the students at all.
Well, one of the things that happened today, you know, like you said, I went into this training for teachers and it was supposed to be about race, but it wasn't supposed to be about politics or the election. And, you know, I looked at them, and one of the women had these big big red puffy eyes. And, you know, they looked so sad. And then they said, this is going to be a long 3 hours, you know, like they were so worn out from their grief. And in the hallways talking to people, it was like we were at a funeral, you know, like, you know, people saying like, hi, how are you doing? But not exactly answering, you know. People saying good morning and other people being like,
yeah.
Not going to say good morning. You know, I said to them, what if we hadn't taken a half an hour to process feelings? Would you have been paying attention to anything that I said? And they said, no, of course not. Like, this is pretty, they had a training before mine. They said, we didn't learn a thing because we're totally preoccupied. We are consumed by this. So until we can process this, until we can have a space to process this, we're not going to learn anything else. So I think for that reason, it's important to talk about it. For the most part, the folks I was talking to today were white women and one black woman, and they were upset about Trump's comments about women. But for the most part, they weren't part of the group that Trump really targeted. I mean, you know, I think that. I mean, how can I say that? He definitely targeted women.
Yeah.
So I can't say, you know, and I don't want to make it a competition, but we didn't have Muslims in our group. We didn't have anybody identifying as gay or lesbian or trans. I think groups that are possibly even more vulnerable under a Trump administration, we didn't have immigrants in our group or anybody who identified as Mexican. I mean, some groups of people in our society right now really have been targeted, have been used and targeted in this campaign. And there's an incredible vulnerability there. When we told my daughter this morning that Trump won, the first question she asked was, will my friend Halima be in school today?
Yeah.
Or is she gone already?
Whoa.
Because she thought if you're Muslim, that a Trump victory meant you would have to leave. Now, who knows what Trump meant when he said that he was going to have a ban on Muslims? I don't, you know,
right.
Did he mean that they were going to be deported? Who knows what he meant? But people are afraid. They don't know what he meant. They feel at risk and they've really been used to stoke, you know, their identities have been used to stoke hatred. And so, you know, if this group of adults and white, for the most part, straight white women was really nervous and anxious and grieving, think about our children who don't have an adult perspective on this, who feel like they're parts of a targeted group and the kind of emotion that they're experiencing. And, you know, on some level, I'm not sure you necessarily have to create space to talk about it. I mean, I think that's important. But if you don't think dialogue is the way to go. At least you have to say to kids in your school or your classroom or people that you work with that there have been a lot of hateful things said in this campaign and that I stand against them. I think we just have to stand up and say that we are here for each other, that I will, that if you are going to try to, if anybody's going to try to deport Muslims or take away the rights for same-sex partners to marry, they're going to have to contend with me. I'm going to fight that. And that the more people we have who are willing to stand up and say that, the more power we have against the fear and despair of what could be. You know, I mean, sometimes I feel like, oh, this sounds so pie in the sky. Like, really, Allie? You know, but I just, like, in this moment, I can't think of anything better than just speaking out and saying, I will not let this happen, would it, you know, in your context, because it's the fear that drives us into ourselves that kind of gets us, it renders us speechless and scared and isolated, and we know that grief is an isolating experience that then just gives more power to the other side.
It does. It does. All right. I'm going to ask you this question, and I'm telling you in advance, there is a correct answer to this question, so I need you to get it right, okay? I need you to on point with this one. Ready?
This is stereotypes at its finest.
Okay. Yes, it's wonderful. Dr. Allie Michael, did you read the comments on this piece that you wrote for the Huffington Post?
No.
Yes, that is the correct answer, and I'm very happy for you.
Yeah. Well, so I have to say I received over 100 emails thanking me for this piece that I really appreciate from people I know and people I don't know and telling me their stories. I've received a couple pretty hateful emails about,
ridiculous.
Like, well, what about what a liar Hillary Clinton is?
Oh,
you know?
Gosh.
I mean, that's not that hateful, but it's, you know, some kind of dissonant emails. And then I also was asked to be on a radio show, and I didn't check it out. I didn't check out the, like, I actually, this is the third interview I've done today, and I stopped checking them out at one point because I thought, you know, all these people are so well-intentioned. And this guy
was
a conservative commentator who just wanted to tear apart my arguments. You know, he really took issue with the fact that I called Donald Trump a mean person. And just every time I responded, he would, you know, he would say, where did you get this information about Donald Trump deporting Muslims? He never said he was going to deport Muslims. And, I mean, it went on and on. And I thought, well, do I have to hang up? Because then he's going to make me look stupid. And, you know, but so I stayed on. And I kept trying to channel my inner Hillary.
Nice.
And afterwards, I thought, you know, that was silly because I don't need to channel my inner Hillary. I mean, I really admire the way that she stood up to Donald Trump. But I also think that this campaign has been really divisive, and I'm really much more interested in connecting with people, which is part of why I stayed on the call, because I want to connect with people who have different opinions from me. And that was not going to happen with this guy, and I can see that now. But one of the things that I wish I had said is, you know, would you get to the third paragraph of my article, or the fourth paragraph, which says essentially that not every vote for Donald Trump was a vote for bigotry. And this is something I believe we need to tell children, because otherwise it's terrifying. But it's also something I believe. I think a lot of votes for Donald Trump were about people's economic fears and insecurities. And what's disturbing about that is that the racism and the homophobia and the xenophobia and the sexism was not enough to make them say, this guy actually is just unacceptable, regardless of what he might offer in terms of my economic fears and insecurities. But we know that is how it tends to work, that when you are vulnerable, your own vulnerability is first on your list of concern. And other people's vulnerability, even though they might be on your list, are not first.
Yeah.
And then part of what happened in this campaign was that whether people had the same racism and sexism to begin with, that was really stoked as part of the movement. But what I want kids to know that, like, just like there are lots of reasons to vote for Hillary. Some people were voting for Hillary because they wanted a woman in office. Some voted for Hillary because she was a Democrat. Some voted for Hillary because they didn't like Donald Trump. Some voted for Hillary because they want to preserve a woman's right to choose. There's so many reasons to vote for Hillary. Not all Hillary supporters are Hillary supporters in the same way. And I think the same is true of Donald Trump. And so I wanted to say to this guy, look, like, I might be one of the only people who's trying to get other people to look at your Trump supporters in a three-dimensional way. So I don't know why you're going to tear me apart, you know. But I didn't say that. I raised my voice and I kept fighting back, and I didn't share my feelings or the impact on me. And he just said, it sounds like you're pretty angry and out of control. It sounds like you're the one with the problem, you know. And ultimately, I just thought, look, like, this doesn't work. I'm here to engage. I'm here to figure out how to move forward together, to have a dialogue in good faith with people who differ from me. If you want to do that, I'm here. But until then, I'm out. And, like, we can't communicate with people who are refusing to hear, who really don't want to understand. And that makes me incredibly sad.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I hear you saying is this interview is going better than that.
Yeah. You know, we might not agree on everything. I appreciate, you know, having some space to talk about this. It's just amazing to be able to listen to one another.
Yeah.
You know, but it's also so much easier to talk with people that you agree with. I mean, I think that's, and I want to get over that. I want to be able to talk with people I disagree with. So my daughter came home from school today, and she was really upset that a friend of hers was supporting Donald Trump. She didn't know that, and she was sad that she said I felt like for a minute I couldn't be friends with her because she supports Donald Trump, and we're mad at her. She and her other friend are mad at this girl, and she's six. And I listened to her for a while, and I said, Tina, I think that part of what Donald Trump does is he divides people against each other. And I think if you stop being friends with your friend because she supports Donald Trump, then in some ways we're letting him win. And I think that I don't think you need to stop being friends with her just because you have different political views. In fact, it's really good for us to be friends with people who have ideas that are different from us because we can learn from them and they can learn from us. And she gave me such a big hug. It was like this, you know, it was like, thank you, Mom, you gave me permission to, you know, not, I don't know, maybe she was doing it because she thought that that's what you're supposed to do, or maybe she thought that's what I wanted, but clearly that's not going to help that doesn't make our country stronger.
No.
To just hate each other because we voted for different political candidates.
And it's not what we're advocating on this show. Again, listeners, this is Dr. Ali Michael. She wrote a piece called What Do We Tell the Children? We are going to link to it. In that piece, she wrote, quote, say that silence is dangerous and teach them how to speak up when something is wrong. Then teach them how to speak up, how to love one another, how to understand each other, how to solve conflicts, how to live with diverse and sometimes conflicting ideologies, and give them the skills to enter a world that doesn't know how to do this. As I said in the intro, Ali, this was my bright spot of the day. This was my sign off on social media to just say, look, everybody, I know you guys need something to latch onto, and here's some incredible words to latch onto. And so I wanted to provide that to our listening audience. And your words really made a difference today, and they were much needed. And so we thank you for that.
Thanks, Ken. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate the chance to have a conversation and to be able to share honestly. Thank you. Thanks for all you're doing.
An eye for an eye will leave the whole world blind. An eye for an eye will leave the whole world blind. We must love one another. Or die. And a baby's a baby wherever she's born, and a bomb is a bomb wherever it's thrown. And the night is the night, 'cause it's all the same sky, and a tear is tear, 'cause it's all the same cry. And the oceans are the oceans, from shore to shore. And peace is peace, and war is war. An eye for an eye will leave the whole world blind.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second incredible guest on this week's episode. Let me introduce her to you. Leslie Neuchow is the singer-songwriter I think we all need right now in this uncertain world. Rolling Stone magazine describes her distinctive combination of strength and sensitivity in her music as having, quote, the grace of an erupting volcano and the subtlety of scent. Love that. Her debut album, Tenderland, struck such an important chord and resulted in her being featured on MTV, VH1, Dateline NBC, a host of different media. And now she just released her second album, Balm for Gilead, which you need to go pick up right this very second. But first, let's chat all about it. Leslie, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me.
We have so much to talk about. First, tell our listening audience why the medium of music to get your voice out there.
Such a good question. I guess the way that I would answer that would be that when I was little, my parents would take me on protest marches and demonstrations, and I loved them and I felt moved by them. But really, what got my heart just bursting with love and energy was the music that was played, the songs that people would sing. That's what really moved me the most. And I found myself, you know, after school or even before I was in school, just sitting at my grandmother's piano in our living room and just playing whatever I was feeling at the time. And that just has always been my mode of expression. So then, you know, following that through and then learning about music and actually the craft of songwriting, it just was a natural fit for me. It's just come from my deepest places.
I love it. Were there certain voices that have always been calling out to you?
Well, there's so many. I mean, the first real, well, maybe not the first, but the folk artists, you know, like Joan Baez, and well, actually my parents always listened to Paul Robeson and Bob Dylan. And then later, Elvis Costello and Joan Armatrading, Tracy Chapman. These are people who really started to help form my voice.
For our listeners who have not heard your voice before, and we're going to play a couple songs of yours, how would you go about describing what it is that you put out there?
Well, you know, I feel like I don't fall into any one category. So many of the musicians that I love don't. But I have come up with something that's kind of like powerful. Because I try to speak the truth. I hope it's powerful, and I hope that, I mean, I feel that it comes from my heart, and I hope that it touches yours. And I think that when we connect to each other, we realize the truth of the matter is that we actually all are connected.
Yeah.
And I hope my music helps us feel that truth. And if we feel that truth, then it's much harder to hurt each other.
I agree. See, this is why we need you this week. And I'm going to be very upfront with people. Leslie and I are recording this chat the day before the election. You are very needed right now, my friend.
Well, thank you. I feel that all of us who are doing our best just to speak, you know, our truths in a very personal and honest way, we're all just trying to make the world just a little bit kinder. And it sounds so corny, but the fact of the matter is it really is true that if we just are kinder to ourselves and to each other, it's transformative. And
yeah.
I hope my music helps us do that in some small way.
Yeah. Is it fair to say, because it strikes me listening to your music, and I actually have followed you for quite some time now, that the world does affect what it is that you put out there?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. And I think that really is the role of artists. In our culture, in all cultures, is to react to our experiences, whether they be personal, political, cultural. And for me, I can get as much inspiration from looking at the ocean as I can from being so moved by where we are right now in terms of our current election and being devastated on the precipice of hoping that, something really disastrous doesn't happen for us and for the rest of the world. So all of these things move me and affect my music for sure.
I was going to ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot, and I never do this with a guest, but I feel that you are uniquely positioned. Were you to sit right down right this second and write a song about this election, how would you approach that?
Oh, my God.
Is that the title?
Oh, my God. I'm so gay. That would be the title. No. I think the title, you know, what I come back to, and it's what I always come back to, and it feels almost like it's just my calling. It's just my calling because it's what I always come back to. It's what I often mostly write about, is this interconnection. You know, when I hear about what's happening at Standing Rock and I see what's happening with the candidate that is not Hillary Rodham Clinton, and I keep coming back to this feeling that, and this truth for me, which is that if we could but see and feel how interconnected we all are with each other, to the land, to the sky, to the animals. We are interconnected. We need each other to survive. We need each other on the other side of the earth, and we need the people across the street. We need each other to survive. And I think that that would, again, be the song that I would write, because I believe that is true. And I believe until we truly recognize that, we will probably keep hurting each other in one way or another.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that Leslie's new single, Oh My God, Election 2016, will be available, I think, next week. It's coming up. It is coming up.
I better get working on that.
I think you're already done with it. I think we're there. I think we're already there. So we have to talk about Virginia Slam, which is where I first learned about you and all the great work that you're doing. Talk to our listeners about what happened there.
Yeah. So this was a while ago. I'm trying to think of the exact year, maybe 1997. I think that might be right, but don't quote me on it. Something around that time. I was, like, you know, so many others in New York City, a struggling musician and working my day job during the day and doing music at night and hoping for that big break and working as hard as I could to make it happen. And one night I was playing actually at the Mercury Lounge, and unbeknownst to me, there was a scout from a new record label in the audience. And the next morning, somehow, the scout got my phone number. I still haven't figured that one out. But they called me at home and said they saw me at the gig last night and said some really nice things about me and said they wanted to sign me. And I had come close to quite a few different signings from big, from major labels that fell through at the last second. And, you know, that's painful. It's a hard road to ride being an artist in our culture, but I was still so excited, you know, when she said this. And she was offering a really nice amount of money and started to talk details, and it was very exciting. And the long and the short of it is that I found out, however, that the new record label that she was talking about and was going around the country to sign the best unsigned singer-songwriters was actually owned by the Philip Morris Company, and was based on the cigarette, the Virginia Slim cigarette. They were bringing it back, and they were targeting young people, particularly young women, the whole Slim thing, to buy the cigarette as they revived it. And they wanted to bring young women into this, what I would call a trap, through using the music of other young women. And they were going to set up listening stations all over the city, and people would hear my music. And if they bought a pack of Virginia Slim cigarettes, they would get my CD for free.
Yeah.
So when I found this out, you know, there's just no way. Like, there's just no way I could use my music to sell cigarettes to anybody, but certainly not to young women.
Right.
It's the antithesis of what I'm about. So I turned down that offer, and, you know, I felt good about it because I knew it was the right thing to do, but also felt really, you know, oh my God, am I ever going to get an offer? And then I realized that even though I turned it down, they were going to find somebody else, you know, in 5 minutes, and nobody would know that I had turned it down. It wouldn't make any kind of an impact, and they would just continue on their way. So I had this idea to to start a concert series. Instead of calling it Virginia Slims, we would call it Virginia Slam, to slam the Slims. And we would hold, well, we did hold concerts on the nights that they held concerts to educate people about what they were doing. And it was an incredible experience. And we did a lot of, I feel like we did a lot of great work. There were a lot of people who joined in, and it became a small movement at the time. And we ended up shutting down their record company.
Yeah. And that's, by the way, and I don't mean to spring this on you, that's where our lives intersect, because I was a junior at NYU, and that's when I first saw you.
Oh, my God.
It was amazing. And I went with a group of NYU students, and we were all studying health promotion and working for the Office of Health Promotion at NYU. And it was just so validating that we didn't have to choose between our desire for greater health and wellness and all of that great promotion and our love for music. And you brought those things together for us. And it was a big moment for me there at NYU.
Oh, and so it's really wonderful to hear that. I'm glad you're telling me. And I didn't know that our paths crossed then. I'm glad I do now.
Yeah, no, big deal, big deal. All right, folks, again, listeners, we are here with Leslie Newchow, singer-songwriter. Talk to our listeners. What is the importance to you of being an out artist?
Well, if we don't live our truths, whatever they may be, it's not healthy for us.
Yeah.
And it's not healthy for others. So my being out is just my being me. I can't be anything else. I'm just here on this earth to be the most me I can be. And that includes, you know, who I love. I've been married to Emily for 17 years.
Nice.
And we have a beautiful 11-year-old boy and an amazing 17-year-old dog. And we live in Brooklyn. And I'm a musician, and she's a writer and a public school teacher, and this is who we are. This is our life. And I can't imagine, I mean, how would I not be out?
Yeah.
This is how I'm feeling, and I feel so grateful to the people before me who made the decision, who made my decision so easy for me.
Yeah.
Because I know it's not easy for everybody now, even now. Who, you know, people who don't live in a city like New York, people who may not have parents like the parents I have. But it's also the people who came before me who made it easier for me to be who I am, out and proud, and not even really thinking about it.
Right. Let me push you a little bit on that, because I'm feeling pretty darn confident that you definitely have been around artists over the years who have questioned whether or not to come out and how it would affect their music. Am I right that you've been involved in those conversations?
I must have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to our listeners out there who are debating that choice, because there really are, you know, look, I would love to be back in New York City, but I'm certainly in a pretty liberal and accepting place here in Cleveland, Ohio. But we do have listeners who are trying to make it, you know, in some locales where it's not as supportive. What advice would you give?
You know, I would just say there's a time in our lives where we can't do anything except speak the truth.
Right.
And that time may be now for somebody, but that time might be next year. But to just say to people who are wondering what to do, to just encourage them to surround themselves with people who love them for who they are, people that they know love them for who they are, and to know that at some point in their lives, telling the truth is just going to have to be okay.
Yeah.
Because until we do that, it's just never going to be okay for everybody. And there are so many artists now, actors and musicians and sports figures and authors who have come out. And again, like I said, so many of us, not all of us, but so many of us have the luxury of the safety of coming out now because of who came before us, that it is a safer time now than ever. So I would say, if you're wondering whether or not to come out, maybe is it possible for you to get to a place in yourself and maybe even physically be moved to a place where you can feel safer to be who you are and loved for who you are. And I guess that's what I would say. And I think it is difficult sometimes, but in terms of the business part of it, I just don't personally experience now that that is a big issue anymore. I'm sorry if that's not politically correct, but that's my own personal experience right now.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Now, I don't know if you know this, Leslie, but there actually was a bit of time between your first and second album.
Yeah, no, I had no idea about that.
That's why I'm here to help. I am absolutely here to help. So whereas we have had some singer-songwriters on this show who are cranking out, I mean, seriously, I'm not going to name any names, but there's one I'm thinking of, like, are you seriously putting out two albums a year? It seems like a lot to me. That's not the way that you have approached this.
No. Oh, I'm so jealous. No, I haven't. No.
I'm going to push you on that, too. Are you jealous? Because I think Bomb for Gilead, which I have listened to over and over, is all the better because you had these incredible life experiences between the first and second albums.
Oh,
I'm feeling confident in that.
I love you for saying that. I really do. I really appreciate that. And, I mean, the space between the two records, I didn't intend for there to be that much space, but life did sort of take over.
Yeah.
My son was born 11 and a half years ago, and I just fell so in love with him that nothing else really mattered to me in at the moment, you know? And I stayed in that space being his mother and in that very kind of close way that you can be with these little ones. And at about, when he was a couple of years old, when I might have, started to explore my own creative voice again, my mother actually got very, very sick. And so I ended up taking care of my mom for about 8 years. And that was, that was a big journey. And between caring for him and caring for her, there really wasn't much space for other stuff. And to be honest, I also just didn't have anything to say yet. I just couldn't even imagine what I would write about. Then after my son grew up more and my mom died, there was that the grief that I experienced with her passing was so, so big. And it really just carved this opening in me. And all of a sudden, just lyrics started pouring out of me. The first song I wrote was about her and her death. And then I just started to have something to say again. And it was so exciting to experience that. And then, over the next year and a half, then the music started to follow. And then last year, I spent the year recording Bomb for Gilead. And here it is, and I'm really happy to be back.
And you can hear them. I know neither your son nor did I know your mother, but you can hear them on this album. I mean, it really is quite evocative of all these different presences in your life that then evoke all these presences in all of the listeners' lives. It's really quite amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. And let's talk about a couple of the tracks from the album. This is the part of the show, Leslie, where we're going to ask you to do a little self-analysis. What do some of these songs say about you? It's always a little bit easier for our singer-songwriters because we're asking you about your own songs. But let me pick some of my favorite tracks from the album. What would you say the track "An Eye for an Eye" says about Leslie Newchow?
"An Eye for an Eye will leave the whole world blind." That song I actually wrote in 2001, the day, well, September 12th, 2001, the day after the towers were taken down. And I saw the smoke from them from my living room window and felt that I, like everybody else in this city, that I had to do something to help. And of course, I didn't, what could I do? What could I do to help? And I thought, well, Leslie, you sing, that's what you do. So, and I do believe people need music. It opens our hearts. Yeah, that's what music does. So I met down at the living room, which was in the East Village then, and I called a bunch of friends and said, let's go sing for the people down at Ground Zero, as close as we can get. Let's go sing for them. So we just walked through the streets singing old spirituals, This Little Light of Mine, I'm Gonna Let It Shine, songs like that. And we reached them as close as we could get, and we just sang and sang. And as we walked through the streets, more and more people joined us. And we walked, and we started walking over to St. Vincent's, the hospital, unfortunately, that's no longer there, to sing for the doctors and the nurses. And it was incredible. By the end, we had tons of people just all walking and singing together. And it's really one of the most moving experiences of my life, because it really showed me how healing, truly directly healing music is. People were crying. We were just singing out from our souls, and people were listening, and it was just beautiful. So for me, that song, I went home after that and wrote that song. So that song for me captures the depth of the healing power of music, and it captures this feeling also that I had at that time. I was very afraid of what we would do in retaliation.
Yeah.
And so those two feelings of music as a healing and the fear of what we would do in retaliation are captured in that song. And I'm so sad to say that it's applicable as much today as it was then.
Amazing stuff. Let me make you do one more. I have to tell you, I have a soft spot for children's choruses. I don't care what the song is. I enjoy any song with a children's chorus. We Don't Need Another Hero, Tina Turner's We Belong, Pat Benatar. I will take a children's chorus any day of the week. And thus, I must ask you, what does the track I Don't Want to Die Before I Die say about Leslie Newchow?
I love children's choruses too, obviously. I really do. So this song, I Don't Want to Die Before I Die. When I wasn't writing, I was engaged in, this mothering, which is, probably the best job I'll ever have. I love being a mother. Caring for my mother was a very difficult and also profoundly healing and beautiful experience. But there was a part of me creatively so many years were going by when I wasn't writing, that felt like there was a part of me that was dying from not making that creative part alive again. And this song is just about wanting to live. It's about not wanting to die before I die. I want to live. And so that's the place this song came out of. I want to be alive for the short time that I'm here. I want to experience life. I want to face up to my fears. I just want to be here. I want to be alive for the short amount of time on this planet. And when I was writing it, I heard kids singing it. And I'm just so grateful that the kids from my son's school could join in, including my son.
I was going to ask. Oh, good. He is one of the children in the, that's wonderful.
He is, and he also sings with me on the last line in the track Rivers.
Look at that. These are resume builders for him.
He also, here, I will also say this, he and also many of the children sang with me live at Joe's Pub at the record release on October 8th.
I love it. The next piece. You released this record. You had your big record release party. That had to have been great.
It was amazing. It was just amazing to play with these musicians. Some of them who I used to play with, who played on my last record. Some are new to me. Great to work with them. Great to have the kids there in an amazing space. Joe's Pub was, it's just a beautiful, beautiful listening room in New York City, part of the Public Theater. And we sold it out. We turned people away. I had no idea people would want to show up after this much time, but they did. And I'm so grateful. And it was a great night.
Celebratory as it should be. Now, I have to ask you, one of my biggest regrets in my life is that I never went to Lilith Fair. It is so unlike me and my taste in music to have not gone to Lilith Fair, and yet somehow I didn't go. You not only went to Lilith Fair, one could argue you sang at Lilith Fair.
You did. I really did. I sang at Lilith Fair, and I sang on the stage with Sarah McLachlan, and I sang on the stage with the Dixie Chicks and Deborah Cox, and it was just, it was an incredible experience. I remember standing there in front of 30,000-40,000 people and singing with them and just telling myself, Leslie, just enjoy this moment. Just enjoy this moment. And I really did. And it was a great life moment for me.
I can't even wrap my mind around it. Did you get to sing Closer to Fine with the Indigo Girls? Because that's really it.
I didn't sing that song with them, but that would have been good, right?
I'm redoing history in my head. You sang Closer to Fine with the Indigo Girls.
I like it.
So amazing. So now what's coming up for you? How are we approaching promoting this amazing 14-track album, Balm for Gilead?
Well, thanks to you, I'm on your show, and I so appreciate that. And I am playing around. I have a gig in New York City on the 12th of December at Rockwood Music Hall.
Nice.
And I'm going to have some gigs in the Northeast, and then hopefully in the middle of the country. It would be really nice for me to come out there a little bit, and then out west this summer for a small tour. And then I'm going to hunker down and start my next one.
I was going to argue, by the Leslie Newchow equation for writing albums, you're due for another one in 2028.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to shoot for one in 2018.
Okay. That's a much different equation.
Yes.
Talk to me about how you debut these tracks for your partner. I don't think I've ever asked anyone that. I'm always kind of curious. Does she have input in the process?
Heck no.
Okay.
No input. No. I will say, what's a great plus about our relationship is that we love to sing together, and she happens to be kind of crazy good at harmonies. So I'm okay at harmonies. She's like great at harmonies. So we do sing a lot together in the house and in our lives and in the car. And this summer I was getting ready to perform again, and we were out west, and so I did a few gigs. Just to kind of warm myself up. And she and my son, actually, also our son, sang backup for me at 4 or 5 gigs in the California, San Francisco area. And, I mean, it's a lot of fun to be able to sing together. So in that way, she's definitely, you know, we're involved in this together. But in terms of the writing, that's like a real solo spiritual kind of thing for me alone. And when I share them with her, I really, when they're finished, you know, when they're finished, I feel really excited to bring her in. And if it's appropriate, if it's a song that's like appropriate to share to our son, I will too. But usually it's just her first, and I'll just say, come on into the living room. I got a new one. I'd love to play it for you. And it's a joy for me to share it with her.
Oh. That's so wonderful. Now, I did watch that documentary a few years ago, 20 Feet from Stardom, about the backup singer. So I feel like I need to represent your son's interests where they might not be represented. What type of compensation did he receive for said backup singing?
Dinner of his choice. Even on a school night.
Okay.
Pizza on a school night.
I feel perhaps that is age-appropriate compensation, so I guess I'm okay with that. But he's going to listen to this interview and say, wait, what else could I have gotten?
No, right, it's true. Well, you know, confidence. He's got some self-confidence from, you know, an 11-year-old boy getting up on stage and singing by himself. I mean, that's pretty good.
You seriously are the mom whose son asked, how am I being compensated? And you answered, you're being emotionally compensated.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. May he feel okay about this interview when he hears it.
Track 8 on the next album, entitled Emotional Compensation. There you go.
Exactly.
There you go. All right. Well, let's finish with some advice to all of our singer-songwriters out there. You know, how do we get our truth out of our head and onto paper? We'll do a little learning annex with Leslie Newchow. For all of our listeners who, you know, they want to get these ideas from their head out onto the paper and out into the world, help them on that process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can say what works for me. And I would say connecting to myself and getting quiet enough to hear what I have to say. Because, you know, we all have a voice in us, that the voice of our truth. And who knows what is that? Is that the voice of God? Is that the voice of our unconscious? I don't know, but it's there. And we all know it, and we've all heard it. And I think getting quiet enough, creating a safe space to be able to get quiet enough to hear what it is we're saying about ourselves and about the world and about the people around us, and then stepping out of our way the best that we can, with a pen and paper, with a piano, with a guitar, and showing up. And then just showing up, no matter what comes out, because it'll be, most of it will be garbage. And then just showing up in some kind of a structured way, whether it's, you know, 10 minutes every single day, an hour every other day, 45 minutes once a week, whatever it is, you make a date and you just show up and you just keep showing up and creating that quiet space and listening to yourself and showing up and giving yourself the opportunity to express it. That's one side of it. And the other side of it for me is also, you know, looking for inspiration, you know, literally saying, I'm going to go on a walk right now for 20 minutes to get inspired. I'm going to go sit by the river for 15 minutes and just see what happens. I'm going to go hear so-and-so perform and see what that conjures up for me. So I would say there's the inner work and then there's the outer work and just showing up for both the best we can.
Amazing. Amazing. Listeners, this is what we need you guys to do right this very second. Stroll on over to leslienewchow.com. We will certainly link to it. LeslienewChow.com. You can learn more about Leslie. You can learn more about upcoming gigs, including the Rockwood Music Hall on December 12th, right there in New York City. And of course, everybody, you need to go where fine music is sold, wherever you need to download it, and get Balm for Gilead. It is 14 tracks. This is what I will say about you, Leslie. Each track is so distinct, and my hope is what I'm about to say next does not diminish that at all, because each track is so distinct and will evoke a different emotion, but there is a narrative thread in everything that you put out there of, I feel like anytime I listen to your music, what I hear is live your truth, be authentic. And it fosters this connection between the listener and your music that is so valuable and, again, so truthful and so authentic. And I hope you know how much I appreciate it, having seen you before and listened to your music for so long, and all of your fans and everybody who's going to now download and listen. It really is a gift, Leslie.
Well, thank you so much. That really means a lot to me. It really does. And I really appreciate you saying it, and I really appreciate you having me on your show.
Again, listeners, leslienewchow.com. Go download Balm for Gilead, 14 incredible tracks. Leslie, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
See the writing on the wall. Don't be afraid to fall. It's getting up that matters. We're all afraid to see. It's our humanity. We don't have to be so battered. There's beauty in everything. If we'd only let it in, there are angels everywhere. I don't want to die before I die. I don't want to cry before I cry. I don't want to go before I go. And I don't want to know before I know. And we all have our stories, full of failures and of glories. In the end, it's all the same. Oh, step into the light. I promise that it's right. Go of all the pain.
All right, folks, that's it for this week's episode. Please, please take care of yourself. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ and allies, all our brothers and sisters out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?